Today is Tuesday, October 12th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Jimmy Duofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, House of Representatives poised to pass debt increase bill.
Members of the U.S. House of Representatives return to the nation's capital today to vote on temporarily extending the federal government's borrowing power to December.
Plus, British warships sail into disputed Asia seas.
We've operated through the South China Sea, we've been in the Philippine Sea, and up into the East China Sea. All of our interactions have been safe and professional. It's a big airspace and water.
Also, world's largest economies hold summit on Afghanistan. Our top story today is in the Tigray region. Tigray forces say Ethiopia's government has launched a major military offensive against them to end a nearly year-old war. The Tigray External Affairs Office said Monday that hundreds of thousands of Ethiopian fighters began the assault on several fronts. The Tigray statement, which also alleged airstrikes, drone strikes, and bombardments by heavy artillery, could not immediately be confirmed amid communication cuts in areas. In a statement to the Associated Press, the spokeswoman for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said only that, quote, the government of Ethiopia will continue to counter the destruction, violence, and killing in the Amhara region and elsewhere, unquote, which it says was caused by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. If it has begun, a new offensive would shatter the ceasefire Ethiopia's government declared in June as its forces retreated from Tigray. They had been pursuing the Tigray leaders who had dominated the national government for 27 years before Abiy took office and sidelined them. Thousands of people have been killed since the fighting began last November. The United Nations and many governments have called for a halt to all fighting, and the United States and European Union threatened sanctions against all parties to the conflict. Members of the U.S. House of Representatives are scrambling to pass a short-term lift of the nation's debt limit. The vote Tuesday would ensure the federal government can continue fully paying its bills into December. House Democrats are expected to have enough votes on their own to ensure that President Joe Biden can sign the bill into law this week. A default would have had immense fallout on global financial markets and routine government payments to Social Security beneficiaries, disabled veterans, and others would have been called into question. But the relief provided by the bill's passage will only be temporary, forcing Congress to revisit the issue in December. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Members of the U.S. House of Representatives return to the nation's capital today to vote on temporarily extending the federal government's borrowing power to December. The Senate passed the debt limit extension Thursday night, approving $480 billion in new borrowing. The extension will avoid a first-ever federal default. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell allowed the two-month reprieve, but has said he won't do it again. Eight of the 11 Republican senators who helped Democrats approve the debt limit increase are either retiring or not up for re-election until 2024 or later. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Britain's new aircraft carrier, the HMS Queen Elizabeth, made a stop in Singapore on Monday as part of a move to reassert itself globally and boost its military presence in Asia amid rising competition among major powers. Britain plans to permanently deploy two warships in Asian waters, where the United States and Western allies are trying to contain China's militarization and island building in seas vital to the movement of global trade. The Queen Elizabeth traveled to Japan last month to mark the start of the permanent military presence, which comes as the United States, Britain, and Australia agreed a regional defense pact. In recent years, China has controversially deployed Coast Guard ships all over the South China Sea and built man-made islands with missile systems to assert vast territorial claims that an international arbitrator has declared invalid. Commodore Steve Morehouse is the British strike group commander.
Recent integrated review highlighted the importance of the Indo-Pacific and the UK's intent to tilt here and have an increased footprint and much more persistent presence. And so, you know, what better way to show that off in the first instance with Queen Elizabeth deploying here for her first operational deployment. So we've been on a sailed seven-month deployment. We're here. It's international by its design. We've been working with 7 of the 10 ASEAN nations. We've visited Japan, Republic of Korea. We've worked with the Canadians, the Australians, New Zealand. It heralds just in how important the region is and the number of nations nations that want to work with us, that, you know, view the world the same, want to uphold the same values. I don't think so. We've operated through the South China Sea, we've been in the Philippine Sea and up into the East China Sea. All of our interactions have been safe and professional. It's a big airspace and water, so we have seen Chinese activity. They've been exercising as they are absolutely able to, and so have we. But there's been no incidents that have caused me any concern.
That's Commodore Steve Morehouse, UK Navy Strike Group Commander. Analysts were eager to tamp down fears of tensions boiling over in the Taiwan Strait on Tuesday at a conference in Taipei on recent developments between Taiwan and China. Tieng Hong Mao, chairman of Taiwan's Institute for National Policy Research, said China has not even yet floated a formula on how to resolve political resistance in Taiwan after winning a potential war, a sign for him that military conflict is not imminent. China's Air Force mounted four straight days of incursions into Taiwan's air defense identification zone earlier this month, involving close to 150 aircraft, though those missions have since subsided. Only three airplanes have been reported intruding into the space on Sunday. Standing beside North Korea's largest missiles, leader Kim Jong-un said his country's weapons development is necessary in the face of hostile policies. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Standing beside North Korea's largest missiles, leader Kim Jong-un defended his country's weapons development on Monday. State media carried comments from Kim saying it was necessary to increase the North's military for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the US and South Korea. Kim made the comments in his speech at the Defense Development Exhibition on Monday, according to a report by state news agency KCNA. Photos in the ruling party newspaper showed Kim standing next to the country's largest intercontinental ballistic missiles that have been unveiled but not yet test-fired. A spokesperson for South Korea's defense ministry said they were monitoring the situation closely. South Korea recently test-fired its first submarine-launched ballistic missile and has bought American-made F-35 stealth fighters. North Korea has pushed ahead with its missile program, and analysts say it has begun a major expansion of its main nuclear reactor for fuel for nuclear weapons. The U.S. has said it is willing to hold diplomatic talks at any time with Pyongyang.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Leaders of the grouping of the world's 20 largest economies are holding a virtual extraordinary meeting Tuesday on Afghanistan, less than 2 months after the Taliban took over the country. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, who holds the rotating presidency of the G20, had pressed for the meeting, saying Afghanistan is headed for humanitarian catastrophe. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi said Tuesday's closed-door virtual summit on Afghanistan would focus on security, humanitarian aid, and human rights in the country. It is being held less than 3 weeks before the G20 summit of world leaders to be held in Rome on October 30th and 31st. Since the Taliban returned to power on August 15th, following the U.S. troop withdrawal after two decades of war, there have been growing concerns about the humanitarian situation in the country. Leaders will hold discussions on how to combat terrorism, how to guarantee freedom of movement, both inside and outside Afghanistan's borders, for Afghans as well as members of non-governmental organizations, and the condition of women in the country, which Draghi has defined a priority. The Prime Minister spoke about Afghanistan in a recent interview on Italian state television. Draghi said that for Italy, the future is about defending fundamental rights, defending the rights of women, and protecting all those who have, over the years, exposed themselves to dangerous situations in order to defend these rights in Afghanistan. A major challenge will be pressing the Taliban on guaranteeing the rights of women who face discrimination and violence, including their full return to schools and to workplaces and their recognition in political life. Only boys are allowed to attend high school, and at present, more than 2 million girls are denied access to education, and Afghanistan has one of the lowest female literacy rates in the world, according to the World Bank. The summit has been extended to the Netherlands, Spain, Singapore and Qatar, which has played an important role in the Taliban's dialogue with the West. Afghanistan's neighbors, Pakistan and Iran, were not invited to attend the summit, and Chinese media reported President Xi Jinping would not take part. But to maximize involvement, various organizations are also joining, including the United Nations, the European Union, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Afghanistan's spiraling economy and the need to provide humanitarian support also to nearby nations taking in refugees are central to the meeting. Italy's Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio has said he has asked for an increase in funds for cooperation in Afghanistan to help civilians. He added that everything must be done to avoid the state from collapsing, because he said if Afghanistan collapses, we will face uncontrolled migration to nearby nations with subsequent destabilization in the area. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The United Nations marked the International Day of the Girl Child October 11th, highlighting the challenges girls face and encourages everyone to help empower the women of tomorrow. Pakistan Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai, who was shot by a Taliban gunman in Pakistan as she left school in 2012, called on the international community not to compromise on the protection of Afghan women's rights. Devon Cohen is the senior advocate for women and girls at Refugees International and the author of a new report titled Afghan Women and Girls Under Immediate Threat, the Responsibility to Protect and Assist is Just Beginning. She says that as the United States and international community engage with the Taliban, they must focus on a gender-sensitive response to the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the country.
It's definitely possible that things will get worse from here. The Taliban have demonstrated and want to demonstrate that they are in control. Now, will they be pragmatic and decisions that help them gain legitimacy in the international community? Possibly, but I think that there's very well a possibility that things will get worse. And we've already seen things getting worse in the last month or two. They've said certain things and they've not respected those commitments. They disbanded the Ministry of Women's Affairs immediately and replaced it with, as people call it, a moral police. But you know, they've replaced it with a different ministry that is to enforce restrictions on women and girls and others. So I think that we certainly haven't seen the worst of it.
What can the U.S. government do? There are thousands of women who helped the U.S. government or were part of the U.S. government programs and will likely be targeted by the Taliban.
So a gender-sensitive response to the humanitarian situation would include a couple key points and key measures. One, it would ensure that women are part of the frontline humanitarian response. And by that, I mean that they're working for these agencies and that we ensure and force the Taliban's hand to say women have to be working in these organizations. The only way to access women in humanitarian operations in Afghanistan is to have women be part of the response. And so I think that's a key red line and point that needs to be taken. The second thing is that when we make decisions as policymakers, we need to recognize the gender differences and gender-specific issues and challenges that especially women and girls in Afghanistan face. So, for example, one of the things I bring up in the report is IDs. A lot of women in Afghanistan don't have identification documents. The U.S. is making policies around resettlement that require documentation that women might not have, then they're being left out. And so I think that is what a gender-sensitive response looks like in terms of humanitarian aid and then also in terms of ensuring that Afghan women and girls have access to international protection.
That's Devon Cohen, Senior Advocate for Women and Girls at Refugees International and the author of a new report on the situation for Afghan women and girls. She spoke with my colleague Jackson Vunganyi from Washington. This is the Voice of America. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is calling on the United Nations Security Council to take action against Iran over its escalating nuclear program. Bennett spoke on Tuesday at a conference in Jerusalem. He suggested that Iran's conduct is every nation's problem and therefore subject to global accountability. Bennett said he's made the case to other leaders that Iran is violating basic international commitments from the now tattered 2015 nuclear deal. The International Monetary Fund is slightly downgrading its outlook for the global recovery from the pandemic recession reflecting the persistence of supply chain disruptions in industrialized countries and disparities in vaccination rates between rich and poor nations. In its latest World Economic Outlook issued Tuesday, the IMF foresees global growth this year of 5.9% compared with its projection in July of 6%. The IMF predicts that for the world's advanced economies as a whole, growth will amount to 5.2% this year, compared with a gain of 3% for low-income developing countries. The forecast called the differences a, quote, dangerous divergence, unquote.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency and Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency's joint BepiColombo Colombo mission recently made its first of six flybys of Mercury. According to an ESA press release, BepiColombo Colombo got as close as 199 kilometers above Mercury's surface during the flyby. The spacecraft is made up of three parts, the Mercury Planetary Orbiter, the Mercury Magnospheric Orbiter, and the Mercury Transport Module. Multiple flybys are needed to help BepiColombo Colombo overcome the sun's gravity as it reaches its orbital positions at the planet in December 2025. Once at Mercury, the two orbiters will separate from the transport module, with one on a shorter orbital track and the other following a longer elliptical orbit. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A senior UN official warns that conditions for millions of Yemenis are horrendous and getting worse as prospects for a political solution remain elusive as the country enters its seventh year of conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations has described Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. The UN reports 20 million people, or two-thirds of the population, need humanitarian aid to survive. 5 million people are on the verge of famine, and nearly 400,000 children are at imminent risk of death. David Gressley is UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Yemen. Behind these numbers, he says, are people struggling every day to find food to eat, clean water to drink, and medicine to cure diseases. Gressley says he has spent the last 6 months traveling the country trying to see what is happening on the ground, to see how people have managed to keep going under these conditions. Wherever he goes, he says, people grab him, eager to tell their stories.
I would be told, as they hold on to me, mothers talking about their children not having access to school, the fact that they face problems with landmines, the fact that they can't go, the fisheries are no longer working, so they don't have a livelihood. They can't access water. This is a tragedy that goes all the way across Yemen. That kind of blockage to access to public services.
Gressley says fighting continues along the front lines and the devastation and evidence of economic collapse can be seen everywhere. He says the consequences of economic collapse are cruel and are driving the unfolding humanitarian catastrophe to new heights.
What I worry about as much as anything right now is the lack of fuel for hospitals, for water systems to keep those systems going. I worry about the fact that public servants don't get paid. How long will they continue to work? They've not been paid since last year. So all of these things are slowly degrading the life of the average Yemeni.
Yemen has been mired in civil war since 2014. The fighting involves the Yemeni government, supported by a Saudi-led coalition, and Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Gressley says he believes the pattern of endless crisis in Yemen and people's hope for a better future are achievable if three critical actions are taken. He says international donors must continue to support the humanitarian needs of the people of Yemen. He says urgent efforts are needed to boost the country's shattered economy so businesses and livelihoods can be restored. Lastly, he says strong efforts are required to support an inclusive political process that will finally bring peace to this devastated land. Experts say Yemenese civilians are being used as fodder by the government, Houthi rebels, and their foreign enablers in their fight for control of the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
European Union officials have warned that the bloc is at a risk of collapse on court unless it challenges a ruling by Poland's top court over the supremacy of EU law. Large rallies were held across Poland over the weekend in support of EU membership, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
An estimated 100,000 people gathered in Warsaw Sunday to show support for Poland's EU membership. Among them was Donald Tusk, the former president of the European Council and now leader of the opposition party Civic Platform. Tusk told the crowd, "What is it that brought us all here today? A pseudo court of justice, a group of masqueraders in judicial robes, by order of the party's leader, in violation of the constitution, decided to take Poland out of the EU. The protests were triggered after judges in Poland's highest court last week ruled that the national constitution had primacy over European Union law. The supremacy of EU law is the legal bedrock of the bloc. Brussels officials Monday threatened sanctions against Poland. Didier Reynders is the EU Justice Commissioner.
We are waiting now for new decisions of the Court of Justice about the situation in Poland, also possible daily financial sanctions.
Those fines could amount to over $1 million a day. The legal case was originally brought by the Polish Prime Minister, Mateusz Morawiecki. He has refused to implement two rulings made by the European Union's Court of Justice in July, which accused the Polish government of political interference in the judiciary. The Prime Minister has denied such interference and said Poland is not seeking an exit from the European Union. Writing on Facebook, he described that idea as a harmful myth. Government supporters have staged counter-protests and say the government was right to challenge the EU. Among them was Zygmunt Miernik. He said they appropriate rights that they do not have the right to appropriate, and they want to interfere more and more. So how close is Poland to leaving the European Union? Piotr Buras is from the European Council on Foreign Relations.
The threat of Poland leaving the European Union is overblown. Poland is a country where more than 80% of the population is in favor of the EU membership. Poland is very much dependent on the internal market and also on the EU funds, including the recovery fund agreed upon last year.
That COVID recovery fund is worth $66 billion. The EU has threatened to withhold the money unless Poland implements the changes to its judicial system. Poland and some other member states, including Hungary, have repeatedly clashed with the EU over the rule of law, media freedom and minority rights. Again, Piotr Buras.
The battle we have now is basically about, will the European Union allow this to happen, that populist autocratic governments disregarding European standards and European laws lead to an erosion of the EU foundations.
Those foundations have been shaken by the Polish ruling. European officials say the bloc must stand by its core principles or risk collapse. But so far, the Polish government shows little sign of changing course. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
China is pledging $23 million to establish a fund to protect biodiversity in developing countries and asking other countries to contribute. President Xi Jinping made a pledge at a UN conference in southwest China that began global talks on protecting the world's plants and animals from extinction. Another session next year will try to agree on targets for the next 10 years. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell Dawson, I am Chinedu Okoh in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Join me on the next Straight Talk Africa for my conversation with the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, about the global fight against COVID-19 and what is at risk for Africa's women. I'll also speak to Fiona Atuwebwe from the World Health Organization about vaccine equity and plans to boost vaccine manufacturing in Africa. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. This